home is a powerful idea for us humans. In fact, it might be one of the most powerful of all ideas. Like, think about it. What does home represent? Is it a place, like a house, a street, a city, or a country? Or is it a family or a particular group of people who are important to you? Or is it a concept, a notion of belonging and safety that you may or may not have experienced before? Or is home a feeling, like that place where you are accepted as you? Like if you're asked the question, where is home? Like, what do you say? Like, I've had a lot of chance to think about this over the course of my own life because, well, as someone who's spent most of that life spread across three different continents and less than a quarter of that life in the country that I was born in. But what about other people who have encountered perhaps domestic violence or emotional abuse, or for refugees and the oppressed? Like, home isn't a place where they're from, but rather a quest that they're looking for. I wonder if for most of us, home is that place of belonging, whether real or imagined, where our yearnings and our longings are at their lowest, or where we feel most fulfilled. And then there's now, like where we have to navigate the notion of home during a global pandemic. And home transitions from being that safe central place to becoming a different kind of safe place that functions as every place. Like home is workspace, it's school space, it's exercise space, it's relaxation space. Like home is now even your church space. And there's probably been a couple of moments over the past few months that you have maybe, just maybe, been willing to consider paying any amount of money possible to just be somewhere other than home. But here's another question. Like, what if you wanted to be at home but couldn't be? And I don't mean that feeling when it's 3:15 on a Friday and you're still in the office. I mean, what if you couldn't ever be at home? In the year 587, the city of Jerusalem was attacked by the Babylonians. And the Babylonians were the world superpower of the day. They had different gods, different technologies, different worldviews, and they were going round the known world, taking over everyone's space. A year after the attack on Jerusalem, the city and the temple were essentially destroyed, and the thousands of people of that area were relocated into various forms of slavery and captivity across Babylon. This is known as exile. Like, they're a people, but they're not at home. And huge sections of the Bible focus on and happen around this period of time. And significantly for this 150 series, several of the Psalms of the Bible are written during this period of the biblical history. The exilic Psalms are generally quite easy to spot by their content, but one in particular is well known, and depending on your age, really well known. The Psalm is 137. It reads like this: "By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, 'Sing us one of the songs of Zion.' How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks." Now, there's a song. with a beginning that will sound really familiar to you if your specialist subject is 1970s Europop, and then a really, really dark turn at the end, like disturbingly dark. Did the psalmist really just say that in the Bible? One scholar said that Psalm 137 has the distinction of having one of the most beloved opening lines and the most horrifying closing line of any psalm. Like, it's a difficult one. But I also think that we can make sense of this, and that it may even help guide us today. Like, so you can probably relate at some level to the opening lines of the psalm, the yearning to be somewhere else. And this is a pretty universal human emotion, except that here, this isn't a yearning that's rooted in greed or desire, but it's a yearning that comes as the result of displacement, or to use the term that we are being guided by in this series, disorientation. The psalmist remembers what it was like to be in exile and speaks to their disorientation in terms of a desire to be in Jerusalem, the holy city, all the while actually being in Babylon. And notice how they twice refer to their status as being there. Like, we were there when really we wanted to be here. Interestingly, the various discoveries that we have about the ancient city of Babylon suggest that this was a pretty impressive place. And being by a river, as the psalm starts, is ordinarily a biblical image of prosperity and growth. Perhaps you remember Tyson's video at the beginning of this series about Psalm 1. And there are lush poplar trees in the psalm also. Yet despite this place appearing at a surface level to be good, it's still Babylon and not Jerusalem. So the response is weeping because this is not where they want to be. They've hung up their harps because they don't want to sing songs anymore. Instead, their chosen action is to remember Zion. And this is not just telling stories around a campfire, but it seems that the psalmist is imagining an intentional and active decision to think beyond their current situation to this Zion. And Zion in the Psalms is, on one hand, it's just another word to use for Jerusalem, but on the other, it's a bigger concept about the place, the space where God dwells with his people. So this psalm begins with a lament about things not being the way we'd like them to be. A lament about things not being the way we'd like them to be. And to think that some people think that the Psalms might have relevance for us today. But wait, there's more. In the midst of this lament, we discover that the captors and tormentors, and that's how they describe their enemy, a torment, they are, well, they're tormenting them. But how? Are they punishing them? Are they torturing them, beating them, starving them, forcing them to make bricks without straw, killing their children? All these things have happened to God's people in the past. But what sort of fresh evil is Babylon bringing down upon this Jewish community? Verses 3-4 tell us. The tormentors are asking them to sing songs of joy in this foreign land. And this is a severe and psychological torture. It's a theological torture. Sing those songs, say the captors, those songs that tell about how God will protect you and guard over you and watch over you. Of course, these songs, which previously brought huge comfort and strength, songs that were a statement of faith and trust, now just feel like shame and folly to sing them here. It's kind of like, you know, buying new tires for the car you just wrecked. Like, act as if everything is normal. This is essentially the request of the tormenting captors. Pretend like everything's okay. And we know a little bit about this as humans. So many of us have attempted to adopt this exact strategy during the last few months of our own torment. We hear people saying, you know, I'm getting more work than ever done during this lockdown, although admittedly that's mostly people without children. I've lost weight, said some people. I'm improving my hobbies. I finally cleaned the attic. But our rising, once again, case numbers suggest that for many of us, the challenge to dealing with any period of difficulty is having the bravery sometimes to stop and admit that something isn't right and that we need to adapt or adjust or be patient while things are worked out. So often, the assumption amongst Christians is that the way of faith is to carry on as normal and to pretend that everything is fine. But here we see that it's the tormentors, the enemies that are saying, act as if everything is normal. Walking in faith or living in faith or however you wish to describe following Jesus might require us to be more nimble and flexible and changeable. It might look like faith to act as if everything is normal, but it might not be faith. And this is the disorientation that the psalmists so often speak about. How do I respond when everything is in turmoil? Sometimes faithfulness involves sticking, but other times it involves shifting. In this case, the psalmist responds to the request for normal behavior with a strong call to remember. In verses 5 and 6, they frame what sounds like a curse by asking that their ability to sing songs and play instruments be entirely lost if they don't keep their minds focused on Jerusalem. They would prefer to be incapacitated for worship rather than forget Zion, which is kind of their way of saying we either worship God or nothing. And the psalmist here articulates a functional aspect of surviving exile. The call to remember Jerusalem is almost an act of defiance in the face of their tormentors asking them to act as normal. Prisoners of war often tell similar stories of how they managed through long periods of seclusion and isolation. It involves remember. Don't forget. Stay true to who you are and what your identity is. When you are surrounded by torment or tormentors, it's really easy to adapt in unhealthy ways. The exiled people of Jerusalem could decide just to sing their new songs or adapt to this new normal in such a way that God became a feature of their past and not of the present, not of the here and now. So how do you remember? See, remembering has more nuance than just digging your heels in. Remembering understands that things are different now, but how do my principles, my core beliefs, my cultures continue in this strange and uncertain time? Think about this in terms of your habits. Times of disorientation give us pause to start new things, but also the opportunity to forget old things. Regular churchgoers all of a sudden find themselves with something else to do other than engage with church programs. And we know that a YouTube video won't necessarily revolutionize your life. But what we're seeing happen for so many of us is that our basic practices and cultures of following Jesus are being dismantled. Like, not intentionally, but simply because we're forgetting them. And I understand that it's much easier to come to a service and have someone lead and teach you. But we're in a period of time now where our remembering, it needs to move from being passive to being active. Sung worship is much, much harder in your own home than it is in a room with hundreds or thousands of people. Learning from a sermon is much easier when you're not watching it, you know, on a device that's constantly telling you about other videos that you could perhaps watch instead. In fact, a friend of mine showed me last week that while he was watching our YouTube video, a suggestion pops up that he should watch this tutorial on the 5 most useful rope knots that he might want to learn to tie. Like, what am I supposed to do with that, YouTube? But yes, it's difficult. But does that mean that we don't try? Like, it's difficult to remember Jerusalem when you're exiled along the rivers of Babylon. But, the psalmist says, try, because the stakes are high for your life. And while it feels like life is on pause in so many ways just now, please don't make the mistake of thinking that this time isn't formative. The decisions that you make, the cultures that you allow, the habits you develop can all be part of shaping who you are. As a person, in your marriage, with your family, amongst your friends, in your workplace. And then the psalmist arrives at verses 7, 8, and 9. And here the psalm's lament becomes what is known as imprecatory. In imprecatory psalms, the writers call down God's vengeance on their enemies. In this case, the psalmist asks God to use his memory and remember how Jerusalem was destroyed, and asks God to turn around this situation and wreak destruction on the Babylonians. I mean, the language is stark. It's crammed with the lust for revenge and annihilation. The extent of this is seen in the shocking end, where the psalmist seems to call on God to participate in what can only be called wide-scale infanticide against Jerusalem's enemies. Like, really? And this is a psalm in the Bible? You know, and once again, those Europop people say, I don't remember this line in the Boney M version of this song. Like, can you imagine this is the latest Christian hit on Shine FM? Like, hey, welcome to 88.3 FM. We'll now play the latest hit from Psalm 137. It's a rough one. A few years ago, there was this controversy in the world of Christian worship song writers because a writer used the phrase sloppy wet kiss in a worship song. And many people were complaining about it for being inappropriate for the church. And I remember at the time as I was watching this controversy go on thinking, like, have you read the Psalms? And the irony, of course, of that song was that the line about kissing was actually inspired by the Psalms. But back to our point, like, what's the psalmist doing here? Are we really saying that the person who kills Babylonian children is blessed? Well, here's how I understand this. On one level, this psalm, as all the psalms, is a piece of art. It's dealing in simile, metaphor, and imaginative poetics. In the context of its time, the psalmist knows that if God simply destroys their current enemies, there's nothing to stop the enemy's children from growing up and coming back for their own revenge. The ancient Mediterranean world was one in which cycles of revenge and violence often repeated themselves for generation upon generation. So what the psalmist is really asking for here is a conclusive end to the whole situation. God, please stop this and ensure it never comes back. Like, the psalm is speaking to God's ability to completely and utterly end the cycles of violence and destruction. This is a request for God's peace, for what the Bible calls shalom, a return to wholeness. But there's also another level that we should observe. The psalmist is talking to God about doing all of this. In our present-day positions of power and agency, we easily read this psalm in such a way that we imagine that the psalmist or the Israelites are the ones who are going to extract this revenge upon the Babylonians. However, they returned home a broken and destitute people to a city with no walls and resources. And even if they did wish to destroy their enemies, they completely lacked the ability and the resource with which to do that. They were essentially helpless and hopeless, unless they trusted in God. And as such, we must read this psalm then differently. It's not a desire to take up action and destroy their enemies themselves. Rather, as Eric Zenger writes, Psalm 137 is not the song of people who have the power to effect a violent change in their situation of suffering, nor is it the battle cry of terrorists. Instead, it's an attempt to cling to one's historical identity even when everything is against it. Still more, it's an attempt in the face of the most profound humiliation and helplessness to suppress the primitive human lust for violence in one's own heart by surrendering everything to God. A God whose word of judgment is presumed to be so universally just that even those who pray the psalm submit themselves to it. So ultimately, this song is a lament about how we act in the face of events that we cannot control ourselves. If we should ever find ourselves in a situation where we cannot change things ourselves, where our individual response seems to make no difference at all to the situation, 137 tells us to trust in God in absolutely every way we can, even in the most base and elemental of human features, our desire for home and our desire for revenge. And this is where I find immense hopefulness in this psalm. Even in the face of an overwhelming pandemic or a situation of injustice or oppression, this song calls us to trust God completely and totally, wherever we are. Like, notice in verse 4, the psalmist asks, how could we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? And at one level, this might feel like the obvious question to ask. Like, things are so bad that surely God has abandoned us, or surely we're beyond God's reach. Surely we have to be here and not there for God to help us. Like, how many of us want to be back in a church building right now because it somehow seems more holy or more sacred? And yet the Bible introduces us to the God of wanderers. This exile from Jerusalem, it isn't the only exile we see in Scripture. Adam and Eve are exiled from Eden. Abraham wanders from his home. The Israelites are constantly displaced and disoriented from where they want to be. And even Jesus himself, he leaves his place to be here. And it's in that last one that we see the eternal truth, that we may be displaced and disoriented and not in the places we think to be more sacred, but this God is with us. He is the God who never leaves, even when in exile. Like, we want the stability. I really do think we sometimes want the stability of knowing that God's over there. Maybe even sometimes we want the excuse of being able to say, because we are not there, we're not going to participate in what God's got going on. It's kind of like how the psalmist says, how could we ever sing God's songs in this wasteland? See, I think the Bible's constant reminder to us that God is always with us, that we can sing his songs in a foreign land, is because we are always living in a form of exile. As Tim Mackey reminds us, exile is the human condition. We're all longing for a better home while we presently live in Babylon. For this psalmist, what made exile so difficult was no one knew for sure when it would really be over. It was a time when things were not as they wanted them to be, and they didn't know when things would return to normal. So if we participate with the imaginative aspect of the psalm here, it's not difficult for us to see the pandemic as exile. Like, we are prevented from so much. We are disoriented about so much. There's disruption everywhere, and we don't know when it's going to end. Like, this is a global exile. But again, because there's so much of Scripture that is written during exile, to people in exile, there's much to guide us. When the great prophet Jeremiah writes to the Jerusalem exiles, it seems that there are three options for life in exile. There's the option to just give up. Like, things are terrible. God has failed us, and there's nothing left to do. And then there's the option to fight and resist everything. Be so insistent that you won't change your way of life that you'll go to your death before changing. And then there's the third way that Jeremiah offers. If this isn't the first time you're listening to me, then you've probably heard me talk about this third way. In Jeremiah chapter 29 and verse 7, the prophet explains the third way to the people. It's not fatalism, and it's not fighting. Rather, he calls them to seek the peace, this prosperity, the wholeness, the shalom of the place where they find themselves in exile. And this is what's there under the surface of Psalm 137, a complete trust in God that says, even in the face of horrible situations, I'm going to leave things in God's hands and instead turn my focus and attention to what I can do to live out this third way now, in the middle of this exile. Like, we can only continue to serve God and do what He's called us to in this moment of history if we trust that ultimately He's going to act to put things right. And so there's one other story that reminds us that this is how God works. It's another exile story. It's the story of Jesus. As St. Paul tells it, Jesus' life is a series of exiles from heaven, from humans, and ultimately in his death, he finds himself separated from everything in the most complete exile ever. But of course, that's not the end of the story. Because in resurrection, we see the power of the God who, in raising Jesus from the dead, shows us that he can overcome even the most extreme exile. He is the God of wanderers and also the God who brings us home. Which is why Paul pens his perhaps most famous words when he says in Romans chapter 8, "What will separate us from the love of Christ? Will hardship or distress? Or persecution, or famine, or nakedness, or peril, or sword?" No, he continues. In all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels nor rulers, nor things present nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus, our Lord. So may you, in your exile, in your separation from whatever it is that you call home, may you, like the psalmist, remember to trust in God, to leave your revenge, your anger, your dissatisfaction to him. May Jesus reorient you in your disorientation and guide you that you might seek the welfare of the place where you are in exile. And may you, by the rivers of Babylon, may you sing the songs of trust in Jesus, even in the midst of a pandemic. And may his grace and peace be with you.